Support for WKAR is provided by the Lansing Regional Chamber of Commerce, supporting more than 1,100 businesses in the greater Lansing area for more than 110 years. Information at lansingchamber.org. And by the MSU Alumni Association, offering opportunities for networking, alumni enrichment, and community involvement with MSU alumni in your area and across the country. alumni.msu.edu.
Welcome to WKAR's Current State, broadcasting live all this week from downtown Lansing's Common Ground Festival. It is great to wrap up a long holiday weekend and expend all of the energies that you stored up over the weekend at a week-long music festival. The stars aligned, I think. I'm not sure we'll see any stars here tonight. The way it looks now, we may not. We have a lot of clouds. We've had no rain, no precipitation. We've got a nice, well, not for a few hours at least. And we've got a nice breeze that all seem to be blowing the mosquitoes elsewhere. We are situated about 300-some feet, I would say, from the Auto Value main stage, where Guster and the Ben Folds 5 and Bare Naked Ladies are the main stage acts here tonight. We're actually a little bit closer to the GM Leinenkugel stage, and they've been performing music over there already for a good half hour at least. But we've got a lot of people. They opened the gates about 35, 40 minutes ago, and there's been a steady stream of patrons coming through the gates. We plan to share the vibe of Common Ground with you all this week on WKAR. A bunch of our stories won't sound at all unlike what you'd hear if we were back in Studio S, but others will. We've been planning on this for some time, and we hope you'll like it. As a week-long event, including nationally known and up-and-coming musical acts, the Common Ground Festival occupies a key place on Lansing's entertainment calendar. The Arts Council of Greater Lansing plays a role in Common Ground, as well as dozens of other similar events. And joining us to discuss the Arts Council's role in Lansing area arts and entertainment is the group's executive director, Leslie Donaldson. Hi, Leslie.
Hi, how are you?
We are fine, and we're glad that you're here. And she's joined by another guest with a particular interest in anything happening downtown. Mindy Bilodeau is executive director of Downtown Lansing Inc. Hi, Mindy.
Hi, Mark.
Tell me, first of all, about you are listed as a sponsor of the Common Ground Festival. How does the Arts Council and this festival actually interact with each other?
Well, a lot of what we do at the Arts Council of Greater Lansing is we support arts and culture in the Tri-County region, and in doing so, we support all of our area arts and cultural festivals through grants and other support mechanisms. And so our involvement with Common Ground is actually as a to provide support to the Architects of Air experience, which I hope everybody comes down to really experience. It's something new and exciting this year at Common Ground.
You've whetted our appetite now. Tell us about the Architects of Air.
Well, I actually have not yet been in it, but it's an enormous sort of inflatable, colorful sculpture that everybody will have the opportunity to experience. So it'll be a lot of fun. I get the opportunity, and my staff has the opportunity to come down on Wednesday for a sneak preview for it, but we definitely hope everybody comes down and experiences it.
Okay, so everybody be looking for the Architects of Air in addition to all of the music and everything else. From your perspective, Leslie, what makes Common Ground special? What makes it stand out?
Well, Common Ground is one of 30 arts and cultural festivals that we support through a network called the Greater Lansing Festival Alliance. And through all of the festivals, there's a tremendous amount of economic impact that happens as a result of people coming into town and visiting the region. So in terms of Common Ground, we're really, really happy to support that. And I know Mindy is excited to have Common Ground in the downtown.
Yeah, it's pretty much where we've grown accustomed to seeing it. Mindy Bilodeau, tell us a little bit about Downtown Lansing, Inc. What is your mission?
Well, we are committed to really fostering a world-class capital city by creating a very vibrant and economically strong downtown district and also the surrounding neighborhoods through design, promotions, business development, and organization.
Okay, and how are you funded exactly? How many members do you have?
We have several hundred businesses downtown There's over 1,000. And we're primarily funded through a principal shopping district. It's a special assessment on commercial properties within our district boundaries, as well as sponsorships and grants and things of that nature.
But it's primarily businesses?
It's primarily property owners.
Okay. And how long has downtown Lansing been around?
It's been around since 1996.
96. Leslie, you were talking to us about the economic impact a minute ago. How far beyond Adado Riverfront Park do you think the economic impact of this event goes? Can you safely say that the restaurants on Michigan Avenue, Washington Avenue, they all go through a bump this week?
Well, and yes, and that's exactly what we want to have happen. We know that Common Ground brings about 80,000 people downtown. Very important, but they're also coming not only from the region, but they're coming from across the state and beyond. And we do know through economic impact data that's been collected by our statewide arts organization that arts and culture plays a tremendous role in terms of tourism and the economic impact of tourism. In fact, arts and culture produces or provides our state about $2 billion in economic impact, which is quite exciting.
When I think of Common Ground, I visualize most people just coming up for the evening with their lawn chairs, maybe eating out on Washington Avenue or Michigan Avenue or what have you, but not necessarily spending the night, as opposed to maybe a Spartan football game late on a Saturday or something like that. Is that generally accurate, or does this event trigger more hotel stays than we might be aware of?
I would say that this event and many of our other arts and cultural festivals that are multiple days or have a big, huge draw, like this Common Ground event does, will have people that will come into town and stay overnight. And that's a part of the purpose of our role in we support re-granting of some dollars from Ingham County through the bed tax to help promote arts and culture outside of our region, to bring visitors in the region and to encourage them to stay overnight. So, for example,
kind of like a pure Michigan kind of thing.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. And that's the reason why through the Ingham County tax, the bed tax that people pay when they stay overnight, the Architects of Era is being supported with that, because it's intended to be a draw outside of the region to bring more people into downtown.
I'm thinking that once you persuade guests to spend the night, that must increase the number of dollars spent just by virtue of the fact that you're there another 16 or 24 hours. That must be a huge determining factor.
Absolutely, and we do know through kind of national data that cultural tourists are likely to spend more money than any other kind of tourist. So we certainly want to see them stay overnight in our hotels. We want them to enjoy the area restaurants, retail. There's lots of places to go in downtown Lansing, lots of places in the region to go to. So we definitely think that the festivals provide that.
Mindy, your organization, Downtown Lansing Incorporated, organizes the next event on the festival calendar. That's Taste of Downtown. Tell us about that.
That's correct. Taste of Downtown is coming up on July 20th on a Saturday from 3 to 8 on Washington Square. So it's our fourth year. It's a great event to showcase all the culinary arts that downtown. We have over 50 restaurants. So food, wine sampling, live music. It's a great event.
The name of your organization is Downtown Lansing, Inc., but how excited did you get when the Broad Art Museum opened in November? I mean, how much residual impact does that have on what's going on in downtown Lansing?
It's great. It just adds to the synergy of the Michigan Avenue corridor and really connecting MSU to the Capitol. It's fantastic. It's amazing just to have a museum at that caliber in our region, so it just helps all of us.
Well, it says something when the Greater Lansing Convention and Visitors Bureau opens an office right across the street from the Broad. That obviously says a lot. Leslie, you mentioned the Greater Lansing Festival Alliance. You formed that group a few years back. This unites about 30 different festival directors and events from around the area. What's the Alliance's mission? What is it that you're actually trying to get done?
Well, really, you know, the Festival Alliance is to support some initiatives with cultural economic development in our region and really support placemaking efforts. And so the festival directors really get together not only to share best practices and resources and learn from one another, but also to cross-promote as a collective group and really promote our region as being festival rich. I mean, we do have quite a number of arts and cultural festivals here. It's our form of public art, and I think it's a testament that all of the festival directors are now coming together to really support one another and make sure that we're, you know, around and festival rich for, you know, many years into the future.
Sharing best practices, that
Absolutely.
Kind of thing. Leslie Donaldson is Executive Director of the Arts Council of Greater Lansing. Mindy Bilodeau, Executive Director of Downtown Lansing, Inc. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
It's Current State here on 90.5 WKAR. Thanks for joining us. We are live from the Common Ground Festival all this week between 6 and 7. If you go boating on the Great Lakes this summer, it might surprise you to know that deep down below you lives a rare species of fish that's been around since the dinosaurs. It can live past 100 years of age, and it can be over 6 feet long. Most of us know next to nothing about the lake sturgeon, but it is a fascinating creature with a stormy history. Nancy Auer is a professor of biology at Michigan Tech University. She recently co-authored a book with environmentalist Dave Dempsey about the fish. It's called The Great Lake Sturgeon, and it's published by MSU Press. I recently spoke with Nancy Auer about the book and the lake sturgeon. She began with the description of this extraordinary fish.
They're a fish that can grow to great size. They can be as long as we are tall, a lot of us. Males don't gain as much weight as females. Females have a little bit more girth. And they have some historic qualities of a what we call a heterocercal tail, or a tail that's much longer on the top part than on the bottom part. And they don't have any teeth. They have barbels, and they actually suction up their food, usually from the lake bottom. And they have scutes on the outside and not a lot of bone or no bone on the inside of their bodies.
Scutes, what are those?
Scutes are very protective pieces of bone along the side and back and along their stomachs. And their whole head is bone covered, not on the inside, but on the outside. They have a bony covering, and that is to protect them from predators. And
it's something other than scales, is what you're saying.
Right. They're much thicker, just like pieces of bone, only they have, especially when they're young, they have very sharp hooks on the end of them. Very almost razor sharp, and as they age, they begin to wear down, so those razor edges aren't as prevalent.
And they're somewhere between the uncommon and rare here in the Great Lakes?
Well, they've been so reduced by overfishing and problems with river corridor access that their numbers have dropped significantly over the years, and as you can imagine, trying to get a fish to make a comeback when it doesn't spawn until it's almost 20 years old. It takes a little longer than with a lot of our other fishes that we're more used to seeing and catching.
They don't spawn until they're 20.
15 to 20 years of age, yep.
That's pretty old in human years.
Yeah, yeah.
And where do you find lake sturgeon? I mean, when you do find them, where do you find them?
Well, normally, like I say, most people don't see them very often because they like the dark, deep areas of lakes. They're sort of the lake vacuum cleaners, if you want, and help keep the lake clean and eat things along the bottom. So most people don't encounter them. They may see them in the warmer months, July and August, when some of the fish begin to move about a little bit and sometimes they'll even jump or breach out of the water occasionally.
But are their populations known? Do we know they are rare, for example?
Well, it's believed by a lot of the fishery folks that their numbers dropped by the 70s, 80s to 1% of what they were historically. And now we are seeing some populations make a comeback, and there are some, like the Winnebago stock that each year has a spear fishery. That one's very intensively managed to protect that group. But there are some stocks in our areas that are making some comebacks, so we're pretty excited to see some of the numbers coming up.
But can you say they're endangered, for example?
Well, they're threatened in the state of Michigan. They're not listed federally because there still are some populations that are being managed for a fishery, so we can't have them both endangered and threatened and have a spearing season for them. But in most normal, regular areas, except for these few where the stocks are making a comeback, they're very, very rare.
We're talking with Professor Nancy Auer, who is a professor of biology at Michigan Tech University. She's the co-author of a new book called The Great Lake Sturgeon. They truly look prehistoric, but what's up with the whiskers in front? What are those?
The whiskers are actually barbels. We call them barbels, and they're the whole bottom side of the sturgeon head is covered with sensory organs, sensory receptors, and they're very numerous. They also believe taste sensors on those barbels. So as the fish cruises along the lake bottoms or river bottoms, it can detect organic material and feed on the dead or dying or organic organisms in the lakes.
Tell us a little bit more about their current status, though, here in the Great Lakes region. Are they generally considered a desirable species that is underrepresented, or are there people who still feel they're some kind of nuisance?
Well, I don't think anybody's back to the nuisance stage. Years ago, they were considered a nuisance because there was so much competition with commercial fishermen. But now commercial fishermen often have adapted their nets to be very specific in mesh and size so that they only collect what they really are fishing for, like, say, whitefish. Or if there are fishermen fishing with gill nets, they're set way up off the bottom, so it's very rare to encounter a sturgeon. Up in the water column more.
Your book is a great mix of science and narrative, and one thing that's really striking is the history of them as, quote, junk fish, and then money fish, and then endangered fish. Mm-hmm. Walk us through that history, if you would.
Well, early on, again, because early fishermen used much more delicate materials, cotton and other substances, to make nets that were easily broken or ripped. Sturgeon, when they were accidentally caught, were kind of thrown away or used for fuel. They were a nuisance fish because most people didn't really know what to do with them. And then as we had more European influence, it became quite a delicacy. Smoked sturgeon as well as caviar were greatly sought. And so that industry then boomed in the Great Lakes, and that's where we got them to be considerably overfished. There was actually a caviar industry in Sandusky, Ohio. We lost a lot of fish during that peak time of harvesting.
And when was that?
About the late 1880s, 90s. By 1900, 1920, most of the fisheries had closed, and most people pretty much wrote sturgeon off as just being totally gone.
And they were used as fuel, you say?
In those early days, because they have such a rich, oily substance in them. They have a lot of fatty material, which makes them excellent for smoking.
Early in the book, it's mentioned that sturgeon may actually eat zebra mussels, which there would be arguably some advantage to here. Are the sturgeon themselves, though, threatened by any invasives? Or what are the biggest threats to their survival in the lakes?
Well, the biggest threat, they can move around pretty well, and, you know, they're not huge at eating mussels. They will take mussels, but because they like the deeper, darker areas of lakes where a lot of, like, cladophora and other algae doesn't grow, they can sustain themselves pretty well, as they have done historically. The biggest problems right now are are all of our major rivers where sturgeon once were. A lot of them are barriered by one, if not more, dams or mill-generating operations that have closed off migratory routes because these fish need good, clean, oxygenated water found in higher river systems to spawn.
Hmm. So they are found in inland lakes as well, or predominantly in the Great Lakes?
Predominantly in the Great Lakes, but now because some of these systems, like if you think of Michigan and the Burt Black and Mullet Lake chain, I guess it would drain into Lake Huron from that whole system, but because of dams, they're blocked, so they are considered an inland fish now in that area.
Okay. Are there different varieties of sturgeon? I mean, is the lake sturgeon just one of many varieties?
Well, there's about 27 species of sturgeon worldwide. All of them are in the northern hemisphere. All of them are big river spawners. But in our area in the Great Lakes, the lake sturgeon is the only species in this particular area.
Why do you find them fascinating? How did you get into the study of this fish?
I had a rare opportunity to visit a hatchery when, gosh, it had to be in the 80s, the early 80s, when people began to think about rearing sturgeon and trying to reintroduce them. And I got an opportunity to go to a laboratory at the University of Wisconsin run by Fred Binkowski, and he was rearing lake sturgeon. And when they're an inch to 3 inches long, they are just the most remarkable and handsome fish you'd ever want to see.
Hmm. And what is being done to help the sturgeon survive? Where does that stand?
All kinds of things now. A lot of agencies as well as lake groups have made rehabilitation plans, and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the USGS, all the departments of natural resources are all working together to, when they encounter sturgeon, to tag them. So most of the fish have a little pit tag like you would put in the ear of your dog or cat that can be scanned, and we know what group it's from and what lake it's from. A lot of populations are now being enhanced by streamside rearing facilities that are popping up because these fish also imprint. And so they need to be reared because they won't come back for almost 20 years. We have to make sure that they get the cue the first time when they're being reared. So they're being reared right on site where we want them to come back.
Very interesting. Well, Professor Nancy Auer teaches biology at Michigan Tech University. She's the co-author of a new book called The Great Lake Sturgeon, along with environmentalist Dave Dempsey. Nancy, thanks for joining us on Current State.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate it, and I hope everyone enjoys the sturgeon.
Nancy Auer, again, a professor of biology at Michigan Tech. The book is The Great Lake Sturgeon. This environmental segment is supported by Michigan State University's Knight Center for Environmental Journalism. You can get more news on the Great Lakes environment at greatlakesecho.org. Current State is coming to you live from the Common Ground Festival in downtown Lansing. We just enjoyed the singing of the national anthem here 5 minutes or so ago from the Auto Value main stage. It's Guster, Ben Folds 5, and Bare Naked Ladies tonight, and the crowds continue to flow through the gates here, and Current State is here all this week. This week is also the official start of the Muslim holiday Ramadan. While part of the month-long celebration focuses on the reading of the Quran, it's also marked by fasting from sunup to sundown. During the summer months, fasting can be particularly difficult. Yvonne Maffei is the editor and publisher of the blog My Halal Kitchen, which showcases healthy meals which are permissible under the Islamic faith. She's also the author of the book Summer Ramadan Cooking. She spoke with Current State's Emmanuel Berry about faith, food, and how to prepare for this month's fast. Yvonne started by explaining why she, a Catholic raised Puerto Rican Sicilian, decided to convert to Islam.
After about 5 years of reading about Islam, I was just curious. I was And I thought of some just really, as much as I read about it, and not so much a deeply religious sense, but more of a, you know, lifestyle sense, I thought that things really hit home to me, and I found that there were a lot of solutions to social ills and economic ills and, you know, just everyday things that really made sense to me. But I didn't, again, I never expected to actually feel like I wanted to embrace it as a religion until probably the fifth year that I started, you know, that I was reading and studying about it. And then it just sort of penetrated my heart, and I felt that this was a decision that I was going to embark on.
Now, coming up is one of the biggest holidays within the Islamic faith, and that is Ramadan. Can you explain a little bit the significance of Ramadan?
The significance of Ramadan is that this is the month in which the Holy Quran, which is the book that Muslims follow as the divine word of God, this is the month that it was actually revealed to Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. We use it as a time to reflect on the meaning of the Quran, and we recite it. Well, most people will recite it and you know, read it throughout the year, but in Ramadan, there's such a focus on, you know, reading the entire book. So it's like, you know, once a year, you know, you're really encouraged to at least read the whole book. So that's one aspect of it, and that reflection on the Quran is meant to give us self-reflection, you know, to really look inside of us and who we are and to perfect ourselves. You know, it's a time of purification, and we look at fasting as a form of purification for us, and that this fasting is, you know, it's a help to us because it helps us to focus on what's truly important, and that is, you know, not the food, but our relationship with our Creator, God, and with our community, ourselves, our family. You know, it's when you fast, you don't have a lot of you're not so distracted by other things. You're really forced to think about what's important. I mean, I can't explain it in this sense. You know, when you're hungry, so many other things don't matter anymore. I guess that's one of the ways I can describe it. And I really didn't understand that until I began fasting.
What was your first Ramadan like, for your first time fasting? Because it wasn't something that you always grew up with. What was that like for you?
Yeah, that's a great question, because I actually started fasting before I became Muslim. I wanted to try it. Like I said, I was very curious about, you know, how this other group of people in the world did things. And the fasting was really a curious phenomenon to me, because I had experienced Lent, where, you know, you abstained from meat on Fridays. And, you know, I thought that was kind of hard. at some junction, I mean, we were having, you know, fish sandwiches at school on Fridays. And, you know, so I thought, how do these people abstain from any food and any drink all day long? That must be so difficult. And also, because it starts at such a specific time and ends at such a specific time, I thought that was fascinating. So I tried it when I was a college student, and here I am, you know, getting up at 10, 11 o'clock in the morning, and the fast is ending around 4:30 because it was winter time. So again, we're looking at the lunar calendar. So every year, you know, the time of Ramadan is actually shifting a little bit. So, you know, more than 10, 12 years ago, Ramadan occurred in the winter. And so this fast ended at around 4:30. And I thought, you know, this is such a piece of cake. I can do this. That wasn't hard at all. You know, by the time I wake up, you know, 10 o'clock to 4, I was 6 hours without food. I was hungry, but, you know, easy. And I remember people telling me, oh, you know, you just wait. When it comes in the summer, you're going to be in trouble if you do things like that. You have to get up in the wee hours of the morning. You have to eat a proper breakfast and then, you know, prepare yourself for the fast, because it's not meant to be done in a haphazard way, and it's not meant to make you suffer, and it's not meant to make you look lethargic and pathetic. You know, it's meant to teach you a lesson and give you some discipline in life. And so in my mind, I thought, well, when the Ramadan falls in in the summer, I better be really prepared or I'm going to be in trouble.
And this year it is in the summer. It's coming up.
Yes.
So how are you preparing for this, you know, differently than your first time?
Well, I think that I had a really good experience last year and the year before when Ramadan started creeping into the summer. Last year it was in the summer and it was quite hot. And this year, so I've had those experiences in the last couple of years. And so what I'm doing is I am getting everything prepared. I get freezer items ready to go, things like chopped onions and garlic and tomatoes and sauces and beans. I do bulk shopping ahead of time. I label everything, order my meats, get everything very, very well planned and put away. The house gets cleaned up. And I also have a menu that I know exactly what I'm cooking for the early morning meal, which is the sahur, and then the iftar, which is the breaking of the fast meal. So I know what we're having every day, and I you know, make room for leftovers and things like that. And it really just helps me plan in my mind, you know, what we're doing. Because the fasting day, you know, during the fasting day, it's not very fun to be in the kitchen all day long. And it's not fun to be in the kitchen in the summertime anyway. So imagine if, you know, you're hungry and kind of, you know, a little bit, you know, your body is kind of slow because you don't have any food in your system. You know, the last thing anybody wants to do is spend hours and hours in the kitchen. And so I prepare really simple meals, lots of marinated things, lots of grilling options so my husband can help me by, you know, doing some of the cooking outside. So that combination of things has really, really helped. And, you know, just having things put up on the menu actually helps my husband help me, because then he knows what's going on and he can, you know, go to the freezer and pull things out. And, you know, it becomes a team effort. You know, once it's visible and on the refrigerator, yeah. You're not the only one who knows what's going on. And so that's what I have been doing for myself, and that's what I've been, you know, trying to teach on my website and in my presentations, you know.
And your book also, which is called Summer Ramadan Cooking, you also kind of share these things and recipes and things to cook for these meals. Give us an example of what a day looks like food-wise during Ramadan.
So that's a great question, because I think that a lot of times we think of, let's say, two meals a day, thinking of it as breakfast and dinner. And in Ramadan, the sahur meal, or the very early morning meal before the fasting day begins, I actually consider it almost like a dinner, in the sense that I don't really have any breakfast foods. I have foods that are rich in protein, like beans, eggs, meats, particularly meats left over from the night before. I throw them into eggs, and, you know, I don't have lots of bread and or lots of caffeine, because I it would not help us throughout the day to crash or to have that, you know, caffeine withdrawal headache or anything like that. And so I'm really focused on protein, and I'm also focused on hydrating foods. So I make things like smoothies that are filled with things like watermelon and citrus and strawberries and, you know, things that are seasonal as well. But we really need to hydrate very, very well. And that sahur meal is the time to do it, because it's the meal that's going to set the tone for the rest of the day. And so my typical meal would be maybe an Italian frittata, and that can translate into eggs of any sort for people, you know, a fried egg, a boiled egg, you know, an omelet, and throw in some protein like chicken or turkey or, you know, something like that, maybe with beans on the side, because, you know, that's a very protein-packed meal for the remainder of the day. And then at a start time, or the breaking of the fast meal, we always tend to break our fast with dates, like one or two or three dates, because that was the tradition of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. It's not something you have to do, but when breaking the fast, you know, date is a perfect food to do that, because it sort of raises your blood sugar level in a very appropriate way, without overdoing it, as long as you're not having, you know, 20 or 30, you're fine. you know, but very moderate. And also having maybe a glass of water or juice, or, you know, just something to kind of help you know, you help you get back to normal, I guess you could say. And then we break for a short prayer. We come back to the table and we have, you know, not a very heavy meal. I mean, your stomach can't really tolerate that much food after having not eaten all day long. So we'll have something light, like a grilled chicken. I have a wonderful recipe for Mediterranean spiced grilled chicken that I use for the summertime, and that's marinated in fresh herbs like rosemary and parsley and oregano and marjoram and lemon and olive oil. And then, you know, that's marinated all day long, and then we throw it on the grill and have it with a side of pasta salad or rice, or, you know, not too many carbs, but, you know, just enough, and a fresh salad. I mean, and that's light enough to get us through the night. And, you know, at nighttime we'll probably have more fruits and vegetables to just snack on, and lots of water and other hydrating things. But I feel like that iftar meal for us is very light because we need to also go to sleep mm-hmm. and wake up very early for, you know, the meal to get us through the day. So, you know, and the food itself, you know, it can be really anything as long as it's halal. And I think that, you know, in the cookbook I try to, you know, make it very international, and, you know, it's not focused on any one type of cuisine. It's very focused on what seasonal for summer, and I encourage people to, you know, have local foods and go to farmers markets and enjoy what's fresh season and in their area, because that's what's, you know, typically healthier.
Why is this period of fasting, why is this something that brings you closer to your faith?
Well, I think that one of the most beautiful things is that everyone in our community is on the same schedule. On the same schedule of prayer and eating and not eating, and you know, there's really a focus on what's you know, what we are so blessed to have. Once you go without food, you are really sort of forced by default to understand people who don't have enough food or are critically lacking in food, and, you know, they're fasting perpetually. Basically, I mean, and that when you start to feel that, the hunger pangs, you become more empathetic. It increases the desire to give charity. And this is a very charitable month for Muslims. We're encouraged to give more to people in need, you know, regardless of faith, regardless of location, you know, to offer food and money and clothing, you know, to people who need it. And we believe that the rewards are greater at this time in doing so. When you're not eating, the focus, you're not focused on what is my next meal? What am I going to have? After a couple of days of fasting, maybe the first day or two, everybody's excited about the meal that they're going to have to break the fast. But after a couple of days, you know, that sort of wanes, and, you know, you have less distraction about, you know, preparing that lunch and preparing that, you know, 6 o'clock dinner, because we're probably not going to eat until 8:30, 9 o'clock. And the focus just becomes on your actions. You know, you're much more in tune with what you're doing, you know, how you're behaving, how you're talking, you know, how your relationships are with other people and with God. And it tends to really bring you closer to God, because you are looking, it's almost like looking at yourself in the mirror, you know, who am I? You know, you have that time to really think about your character. And I think most people do feel that by the end of the month of fasting, that something in them has changed, you know, something hopefully for the better. And they're, you know, you're looking at what can I do better for the rest of this year, for the rest of my life. And so it has an impact. And I think it's a very individual impact, you know, on people, and collectively as a society, hopefully that makes the whole community better for having been through that experience.
Yvonne Maffei is publisher of the book My Halal Kitchen and author of the book Summer Ramadan Cooking. Yvonne, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's current state here on 90.5 WKAR. We are coming to you live this Monday evening from the banks of the Grand River here at Adado Riverfront Park. All This Week, Current State broadcast live from the Common Ground Festival and the seated area here near the Auto Value main stage just keeps making its way further and further back. So it's just about to us here as patrons continue to walk through the gates here into the park for Guster and Bare Naked Ladies and Ben Folds later on tonight. Bob Harvey is one of the Lansing area's most popular bands ever. After a decade and a half apart, they're playing together again and will appear at the Common Ground on Tuesday. Current State Scott Pohl went to a local restaurant to talk with guitarist Dan Matheny and singer Wordsmith, who explains where the band's name came from.
Dan Stecko and Scott Culling, the two founding members of the band, really started the band as sort of a bebop jazz thing with a sax player. There were no vocals. And then they found me. So they already had the name Bop Harvey, imagining an invisible rabbit somehow combined with bebop jazz before I came along. It just happened that then we turned in a direction that was more roots reggae, and maybe some people heard that as an echo of Bob Marley, but it wasn't intended to be that at all.
Well, I was going to ask you about ska and reggae influences in those early days. I was lucky enough to see Bob Marley in Ann Arbor one time years ago at Hill Auditorium, one of the great concerts I ever saw. And so the timing of you guys coming along with that kind of music was really apropos of the times. There was a lot of popularity surrounding reggae acts as they toured. So would you say that sort of thing was one of the reasons why you found such great local popularity?
That's one reason, but I think reggae in general is kind of a timeless music. You can't really categorize it as 50s, 60s, 70s, or 80s. It just sort of has its own feel or its own attraction. And that in some ways made the music both danceable and unique, and it also allowed us to get in where, you know, maybe if you were playing a particular niche of rock and roll or something, then you were limited. This, once you got people on the dance floor, you know, the rest followed.
And as I recall, virtually nonstop gigging was a big part of why you got so popular, too. You guys played a lot of shows.
We did. We played just up and down the Eastern Seaboard and all around the country for 9 years, and started out with full steam just going in all different directions wherever people would book us. We'd play up to 200 shows a year sometimes or more. So we were busy campers for a long time.
Tell me when you came along for the band.
Let's see, I auditioned in 1987 and got the call in January of 1988. And I started right then, and I think we moved east a few months later. So 88 is when I joined the band.
And one of our guitar players, our original guitar player, Steve Shohai, is back with the band. So the band, instead of being a 7-piece as we were all those years, is now an 8-piece. We were a 10-piece when we got together in 2009 for our 25th anniversary shows at Rick's in East Lansing with a huge horn section. We just said, anybody who was in the band and wants to be a part of this, come and join us. And that was sensational. It was almost like a Tower of Power horn section.
Research including poking around on YouTube looking for clips and that sort of thing. And I found a really interesting clip from 1993 when you were on Late Night with Conan O'Brien. And so we're going to hear Conan O'Brien introduce you guys and some of the music from that night.
My next guests have performed over 2,000 shows around the world. Last year, they even found a fan in President Clinton who personally invited them to appear at his inaugural celebration. And here tonight, they're going to perform a song from their latest CD, The Monster Butt Beat Dance Test. That's a title, ladies and gentlemen. Here they are, Bob Harvey.
Scott, it was April of 1994 when we actually played the Conan O'Brien show, and that was the last week that the band toured, actually, matter of fact. We ended up with the last show at the Majestic Theater in Detroit before we put it off the road for 15 years.
Well, you know, it's interesting that you say that, because what I was preparing to ask you was if you thought you had it made with a national TV appearance, and then it turns out you broke up shortly after that.
We did think, we were thinking, why is this happening now? Previous to that, we had played rallies for the candidate, Governor Clinton, before he became president, and we played the inauguration festivities in January of 93. So we were getting a lot of high-profile press, and that, amongst other things, allowed us to get in on the Conan O'Brien show. But it just happened to come on what we knew was the last week we were touring, and we had actually stopped touring in the fall of 93. We had to get back together for a couple of weeks to rehearse before going on the road in April of 94 to do those shows. But it was bittersweet, because we knew this is possibly our big break, and at the same time,
second to last show,
we're putting it to bed for a while.
So explain the breakup. What happened?
Well, after 9 years of constant touring and as many dates as we were doing, a couple of the two guys that started the band in particular, were looking at marriage and settling down and thinking about turning the band into an XTC-style band where we would just record and put out recordings. And one of the fellas wanted us all to live in New York City, which was really impractical. So we didn't officially break up, but we just stopped touring, stopped recording. And so many years later, we just decided, well, hey, this music is still as good as it was. Let's try it again. And coming up on the 25th anniversary, we decided to do some shows at Rick's in East Lansing. And that's what kicked it off here in the new millennium.
We did those shows and found that, hey, this still works, and let's do some more.
I also realized how much I enjoyed playing with a horn section again. It's just so terrific. Our sax player, Eric Corti, rivals John Coltrane in his ability to solo. It's just unbelievable. Makes the hair on the back of my neck stand up when he plays some solos. Just sometimes it's a one-note solo, and he can just make you your jaw drop. So it was such a pleasure to be back playing that music again that I think we decided that we'd take whatever opportunities came our way. And we've also been working on a little bit of new music, so the future is open.
15 or so years apart, what were you doing musically during that time?
I stayed in New York City after the band for a while. Did kind of guitar player for hire. And I came back here, actually finished a degree at MSU, and then I played with the band The Verve Pipe for about 6 years. And then just started recording stuff after that and doing bop stuff. So, yeah, I did Verve Pipe for a while.
And I formed another band called Daddy Longlegs shortly after Bob Harvey. And we toured for 5 years in the tracks of Bob Harvey, the same venues, until that band broke up at the end of 1999. And I still play in a bluegrass country hybrid band we call the Harvest Men. So that's my side project.
So in the old days, it was 200 gigs a year. How many gigs are you guys playing these days?
Bob Harvey does maybe 3-4 a year now at the most. We'd probably take more if the opportunities were there, but we also all have our day jobs and careers, so there are obstructions to doing what we used to do.
You mentioned new music. Is there likely to be a new album release?
We're hoping that we can get enough of it together to do that. We have one or two new songs in the works. We have a couple of new covers in the works. So the future is open, and I think we are looking toward that as a real possibility in the future.
These reunion gigs, I know that when word gets out that you're playing again, word spreads, excitement builds. People come to the shows, they wear the old T-shirts that they bought 20-plus years ago at your gigs. It's got to be a lot of fun to see familiar faces and play to crowds that bring that sort of enthusiasm to attending a show.
It certainly is. It's like a big family reunion. It really is.
It really is.
You see so many familiar faces that you had forgotten that you knew until you see them again. You may not know their names, but you really know those faces and smiles, and they look a little older. But when we played Rick's in particular, it was really odd because Rick's has now become sort of a young person's place. I mean, it always was a young person's place. It's definitely not what it used
live
to be.
Music.
It used to be a blues band, blues club almost with live music. Now it's a hip-hop DJ place, and there was an island of older people in this crowd of young people all around them, and the young people, when we first played down there in 2009, they were just puzzled as to, who are all these old folks, what are they all doing here?
And we brought them around, though. They really enjoyed it. I had a lot of kids after that, you know, saying, who are you guys, and where did you come from? I've never seen anything like this at Rick's, so it was pretty nice.
And I'll bet a lot of those people, when they come to your shows, are bringing their own kids now.
Absolutely. I see kids, little kids with old Bob Harvey shirts on. And we had some really rabid, loyal fans that used to follow us around. And they're still out there.
Well, an event like Common Ground is a perfect opportunity for those folks to bring their kids to see you again. Really good to meet you guys. Good luck with your Common Ground concert on Tuesday night. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Scott.
Yeah, thank you, Scott. Thank you very much.
For Current State, this is Scott Pohl.
Again, Dan Matheny and Wordsmith of Bop Harvey. They play the Liney Lodge stage here at Common Ground, 8:30 Tuesday night. Coming up tomorrow, we learn about an education program designed to help military medics transition to paramedics. Also, we discuss rock camp and music with the Outer Vibe. All of that and more, Current State, live from Common Ground tomorrow evening. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.
Support for WKAR is provided by MSU Federal Credit Union, providing credit union members with 24-hour account access online and now on your mobile internet. Insured by NCUA.